You're listening to the Sound Atlas.
Okay, whenever you say count it off.
I will tell you that I was recording there, but we won't put that in the...
Good deal. Okay, okay.
Tommy Starr hanging out with you on this week's edition of the Sound Atlas. And in the studio with us today, a gentleman that really needs no introduction, but since you can't see him, I will tell you that Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters is with us today. Hello, Greg.
Greetings, Tommy. How are you?
I'm doing very well. The Kentucky Headhunters, we could also put Rufus Huff in there, the Greg Martin Group, Mighty Jeremiah's. Who else?
Itchy Brother.
That's right.
Who else? Well, if you want to go into some other genres, we could say the Ronnie McDowell Band, you know.
Oh yeah, back yeah, in the early
guitar
days.
Guitar for Ronnie McDowell.
Yeah,
you know. Then we can go into Louisville, but now I think you hit the crust of it. Mm-hmm. You know,
been around for a bit, played in a couple
of
bands.
I'm an old feller now.
Oh come on, don't start that.
No, I don't mean that.
You're an older fellow.
Vintage,
not old.
Vintage.
Well, old is kind of a state of mind. Age is all in your head, the way I look at it.
You're only as old as your birth certificate says you are.
That's right. That's where I was going with that.
Thank you. Today, I do have a Medicare card.
Well, is that good or bad?
I think it's great.
I think it's great.
I think it's groovy.
Are you enjoying it?
Yes.
Do you sometimes go, just put that on my Medicare card? And they go, well, we can't do that, sir.
Well, I tried at McDonald's. It don't work too well.
Does it work?
I do get senior discounts, though.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That just means you've been around and done some cool stuff. More
I'm chasing
cool stuff.
Kenny Lee, man.
You know, we should maybe get Kenny Lee on here.
You got to get Kenny Lee on here.
Wow.
You got to.
Yeah. Actually, I think I was talking to somebody about that, but we need to do that for sure. But we're here today talking to you about all things Greg Martin and then some. Is it true that at one point you were with Lynyrd Skynyrd?
Yeah. And let's see. Back in 92, Steve Wilson, our front of house engineer, and I, just out of the spur of the moment, we were in Memphis. We played the me and Richard and Fred, along with I don't think Doug was involved. Yeah, maybe Doug was there. Yeah, Doug was there, but Ricky Lee wasn't there. I don't know where Ricky. He was missing in action somehow on this one. And we did this deal for the Memphis Horns at the Pyramid, and so we were in Memphis a couple of days. So we had a week off or a couple weeks off. So Steve and I just decided to drive down to, you know, we were going to stay over in Memphis, and we'd go to Helena and, you know, go to Delta, go check out, try to find Robert Johnson's grave, Sonny Boy Williamson's grave, see some of the sites.
Yeah, run around a little bit.
Run around a little bit through the Delta, and took a few highway signs, but I think the statute of limitations have run out now, so I can tell you that.
Good.
You know,
that's good.
Uh-huh. That's another story.
Uh-huh.
But then we decided, because the Dallas Guitar Show was going to be happening that weekend, we decided to just drive on down.
Uh-huh.
Drive on down to, my buddy Kevin Woods was down there, and he said, come on down, man, buy you some guitars. Of course, I had a little extra money back then, and guitars were cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
But lo and behold, I meet Ed King, you know, and very interesting. We'll talk about the 58 Les Paul a little later on.
Absolutely.
But he
yes.
knew I had the 58 Les Paul, and he was wanting to see it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was rushing to see it because he had had an old Les Paul stolen, and he thought maybe that was it. But it's another one.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the one.
What year are we talking that you guys were on this adventure?
1992, in the spring of 92.
So 92, you guys were running around down in Texas, running to Ed King.
Running to Ed King. The first thing he does, he walks up to me and says, okay, are you guys a rock band or a country band? And I'm going, okay, this is a loaded question. And I was thinking, why does Ed want to know this? I said, well, we're really a rock band with a country singer, but really we got more rock. And he said, I believe that. He said, he told me he was in the shower one day, and he heard us on Farm Aid. He heard Wishing Well kick in, and he said he about broke his neck getting out of the shower to see who it was.
Uh-huh.
And he became a fan of us. And we hit it off. And he saw my Les Paul, and then once he determined it wasn't the stolen Les Paul, you know, he was a lot more friendlier.
Yeah.
And then he said, I picked up, he said, play Sweet Home Alabama. I played it. He said, wrong. He said, you're playing it wrong. And I said, well, sure. You know?
Uh-huh.
And we just hit it off. I think we ended up playing a little bit together at weekend, you know, and he took my number. I took his. Fast forward to about around April, May, probably around May, I was out Yeah, it was late May because I was cutting. It's back when I was had more ambition and I was cutting the grass in the yard. You know. Uh-huh. And we've got a big yard, pretty uh-huh. big. And so I went inside. I took a break. Went inside and I had a an answering machine on the studio phone, and it was a call from Ed King. So Greg and said, King, I've broke a finger and I can't play. I was wanting to know if you would come out and play some shows, sub for me.
So he was with Lynyrd Skynyrd at this time.
Oh, yeah.
This mm-hmm. happened, mm-hmm. and they were like, oh, what are we going to do? And he goes, yeah. I know somebody.
Yeah, 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 yeah. He said, would you come out and do it? You know, and of course, back then, I mean, now I think about it, I'd go, I don't think, well, I'm glad I did it. Don't mm-hmm. get me wrong. But I said, well, sure, I'm off, you know. And I now that I think back, I go, man, they should have got somebody to play the Stratocaster mm-hmm. that really knew those licks, because I don't play nothing like Ed. No mm-hmm. one played like Ed King. But anyway, you know, I said, sure, man, I'll do it. Because I thought, wow, that's a huge honor to go out and play with Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Sure.
You know, and it was about 3 weeks worth of shows, mm-hmm. which I think ended up being like 9 shows in all.
So the Headhunters were off the road?
Yeah, we were off the road. This was a really strange time for the Headhunters because we were off the road, but there was the little inner tension going on. Mm. This is right when the original bunch was starting to split, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And matter of fact, at the end of the Skynyrd run, about a week later, it went bam. The original bunch blew up in our band.
Sure.
And Ricky and Doug left, but that's a different story. Mm-hmm. So anyway, when I told Ed I would do it, Gary called me. We chatted a little bit. They sent me some CDs, sent me a box set maybe, and some, which it's always good getting CDs.
Absolutely.
You know, and told me what songs they would be doing. And so I went to work, you know, learning them the best I could. Then I flew down to Jacksonville. This is where it gets a little crazy. Rehearsed with them for about a week. Then I flew back home. Seemed like Headhunters had to go to an award show. I flew out there. Mm-hmm. And then I flew from L.A. to Louisiana to hook up with Lynyrd Skynyrd and started doing shows with them, you know.
So you went down, you did a week's with them to kind of, mm-hmm. you know, everybody to kind of mesh. Mm-hmm. Then you had to go take care of some headhunter mm-hmm. business.
I went home.
Yeah. And then Louisiana, first show.
Yeah. Louisiana was, I can't tell you where. I could find out this stuff. It would be easy enough to get online and go to their database, you know, and figure it out. I probably got the itineraries at home in a box someplace too. But anyway, I went to Louisiana. Now, this is where another twist of fate. So I get there, and who runs down the hall? Here comes Black Cat Bone, David Angstrom, Mark Hendricks, you know, my stepson, John.
Were they there for the show or there to open?
No, they're opening the show.
Oh,
they
wow.
They had no clue that I was even playing with Skynyrd on them. They had no idea. So they ended up doing about 4 or 5 shows while I was out with them, maybe 3.
That's kind of cool.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
So they had no idea,
no,
and then they see you walking down the hall.
No, because, you know, back then, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have cell phones mm-hmm. and just didn't keep up. Like, now we know where everything's going on with everybody.
We know where everybody's at all the time.
So, you know, they had signed their deal and were out promoting their first album. They were out. They did a few dates with Skynyrd. They did a few dates with the Yngwie Malmsteen and different people like that. So anyway, I did the first date in Louisiana, and I don't have no idea where we went after that. Memphis, maybe. Memphis in May. Does that sound right?
Memphis in May. They do that every year?
Yeah, okay. It was in May because we did that together.
Would you happen to know, there's that picture of you with them that mm-hmm. we see all the time. Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know where that photo was taken? You know the one I'm talking about.
That was probably Pittsburgh or somewhere in the Carolinas. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. Yeah.
So did you enjoy yourself out with Lynyrd Skynyrd?
Yeah, I enjoyed. I really liked every one of them. I know it's been documented that there was a lot of turmoil going on out there as well, but I didn't really feel it. There was 2 buses. I was on the bus with Ed, Leon, Billy, myself, and some of the crew. And then Gary, Johnny, Dale, and who else was on the other, you know, on the other bus? Mm-hmm. Randall Hall may have been on the other bus, the other guitar player. And Kurt Custer, the drummer at the time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I enjoyed it. It was a little nerve-wracking because mm-hmm. after I got out there doing it, I went, I'm a Les Paul guy. and I don't really play anything like Ed King. Yeah. And I don't even know why he's got me out here doing it.
Apparently, you guys just kind of hit it off.
We hit it off, yeah. And he just gave me a shot at it, you know, and it's just something I always carry with me. That it was a great experience, yeah. You know.
So about 3 weeks, you were a part of Lynyrd Skynyrd. So somewhat.
Yeah, I was actually offered a job with them in 94. A
couple years later, they said, you want to join full time.
Yeah, one morning on February 94, January, something like that. Gary called me one morning. Greg, this is Gary, you know. It's Randall had left the band, mm-hmm. Randall Hall, and said, we're going to be looking for a guitar player. You were the first guy that we thought of. And I said, oh, wow. Well, at that point, you know, we were trying to put the Headhunters back together. We had put the Headhunters back together. Had the split with the Phelps boys, so we'd brought in Anthony and Mark. So we were just trying to establish that we were still around. And I said, Gary, I need to think about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was an honor to be asked, you know. But as soon as I hung up, I went, man, I can't do that. Well, that's not what I was supposed to do.
Was it somewhat like you were going to have to leave something that you helped build?
Yeah.
To go over to this established band?
Yes. And also, at the time, the band was kind of struggling to mm-hmm. fortify the identity, you know, like, hey, we are still here.
Sure.
You know, I mean, basically, the band imploded and the whole thing just kind of blew up there, you know, for a bit.
Yes.
You know, in June of 92. Mm-hmm. Right when I got done with that Skynyrd run, it was, you know, I think I started like mid-May and into early June. And then when I came off the road, you know, the Headhunters just kind of split.
Well, you mentioned Ed King. Let's go ahead and talk about mm-hmm. The guitar. And let's tell everybody what the guitar is. When I say
the guitar.
Yeah, the guitar.
That's what Ruth calls it. The guitar.
The guitar. Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's a 1958 Sunburst Les Paul with PAF pickups. An original. Mm-hmm. Everything's original except someone did change the tunematic bridge, which is no big deal. Uh-huh. You know, no big deal on that. That guitar was acquired by Ed King through a trade. We think it came from a gospel group. Mm-hmm. I think Ed got it from a gospel group out of Ohio. Because on the case, there's a king's crown, like a crown you would see that, like with the King of Kings, you know, Jesus or something.
Absolutely.
You know, and I never put all that together, but somebody else told me they thought that it come from a gospel group.
So you never asked Ed that, or he didn't know? Or?
Ed wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. Ed got it in a trade, and soon he had already had it, this 59 Les Paul that he calls Red Eye. Mm-hmm. The one that got stolen. Mm. And so when he got this 58, he didn't really need it. So he took it to George Gruen's, or Gruen Guitars in Nashville, and he put it up for sale. Mm-hmm. Lo and behold, I've got a picture of it in the case when it was for sale, and in the same case as Paul McCartney's left-handed Les Paul, the one that Paul would end up buying.
Wow.
So it was in good company. So anyway, Ed ended up selling it to Hank Williams Jr. Hank Williams Jr. came in, supposedly going to do a blues album. He bought a Dobro, a Gold Top 57 Les Paul, and he bought the 58. Mm-hmm. So Hank had it, you know. And this is another one of those things that gets a little crazy. About 1988, I think, me and Doug were with Ronnie McDowell. We were playing Jackson, Mississippi at the State Fair. Hank was playing in the big Coliseum. Ronnie McDowell was playing a smaller stage out on the grounds. Mm-hmm. And during the show, we're playing, and we notice this guy with long hair kind of watching us, you know. And afterwards, he comes up and introduces himself and says, hey, my name is Bud Phillips. I'm Hank Jr.'s guitar tech, like what you guys do. Uh-huh. He didn't know anything about the Headhunters at that point. The Headhunters were together, but they weren't really doing anything, mm-hmm. you know, at that point. And he said, would you guys like to come over on over my station and watch the show? I said, yeah, sure, uh-huh. you know. Yeah. So he got us backstage, and we went up and watched Hank. And I saw somebody in Hank's band playing at Les Paul at night. Uh-huh. I'm not sure if it was Animal Turner or another fella. I'm not really sure who had it at that point. That was the first time I ever laid eyes on it. And, you know, I remember talking to a couple guys in a band about the guitar, you know, because it just didn't see those guitars very often. So lo and behold, you know, we never thought much about any of this. You know, we thought, you know, the headhunters were going. But at that point, I don't even think we had a contract, or even there could have been something in the works that I can't remember. But regardless, we go up to when we sign our deal. First album comes out in the fall, October of 89. Mm-hmm. Hank wants us to go out on the road with him in the spring of 90. Mm-hmm. And there's that guitar again. You know, and he let me borrow the guitar to shoot the O Lonesome Me video. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I plugged it in. And as soon as I plugged it in, I went, oh, my God, this is pretty much where the rubber meets the road. I started seeing Jesus and Mary dancing and all kind of stuff.
Were you hearing Gary Wright, Dreamweaver?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty cool, man. So anyway, you know, so I had the guitar out on the road for a bit. And then it seemed like his birthday bash down at Starwood that summer. I'd had the guitar for about 2 or 3 months, and I knew it was time. I had to go give it back to him.
Oh, he actually let you borrow it for a while.
Yeah, he let me borrow it for about 2 or 3 months.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, back then we'd do a few dates with him, then we'd take off and do dates on our own. It seemed like we were off from him for a while, and he didn't seem to mind me having it.
Uh-huh.
And so during his birthday bash, and it had to be, I'm thinking 90. I'm pretty sure it's 90. I had it during the video shoot of Dumas Walker, which would have been spring of 90, right? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, when I took it back on the bus, he was having a pretty good old time during his birthday.
What, Hank Jr.? I can't even imagine that.
Hank, you know, well, Hank's a great guy. I mean, one-on-one, he's very, he comes off like a hellraiser on stage, but he's kind of introverted, really. Mm-hmm.
He's got to put that persona on when he hits the stage.
Right. Yeah, he does it well. Nobody does it better than him. And so I took it back, and he said, man, you should have enough money to buy one of those now. Of course, I didn't have the money. And really, basically, the gist of the thing, he said, keep it. Just take it. Keep it.
Just like that.
And that was it.
You're set on a bus, and he said, you know what? That's yours now.
Basically it. I still got it. He knows where it went.
Yeah.
He hasn't sent the police after me.
No.
That was at least 90? How many years is that now?
That's been a while.
We're talking about 27, 28 years now.
Yeah, yeah.
So
I would say that it is your guitar, because since then they've mm-hmm. taken it down to Nashville and looked mm-hmm. it over and released.
The Gibson Custom Shop, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, mm-hmm. Did what they call a collector's choice number 15, which was a copy of it. They were supposed to do 300 guitars. They did around 240. So they sold them all, but uh-huh. they quit doing the collector's choices. So I don't know if they'll do it again as a collector's choice, or eventually they might just do a copy of it. Yeah. I'm not really sure.
That's still really cool. I mean, be honored by that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So there we go. So, I mean, you know, that's that's one of those stories that I'm sure you've told many, many, many times.
Many times.
We caught it on audio.
You got it.
So we got it.
You got it. It's a interesting story. I mean, you know, I'm it's a 58 Les Paul. It's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of people try to buy it. I had one guy look at me one day. Sell me your Les Paul. Yeah. And they come back again. I said, no, it's not for sale. Had somebody offer me crazy money. I said, no, it's not for sale.
Well, you know, maybe someday that may happen. But the thing of it is, you are so known for that guitar. It really is a piece of you.
It's really a part of me. Mm-hmm. I don't take it out and play it as much as I used to. Mm-hmm. It's just too much. I've got some nice newer Les Pauls.
Sure.
That if something happened, it wouldn't be a travesty, so to speak, you know, it wouldn't be a bad thing. Because I have to tell you, Tommy, I mean, what got me into Les Pauls was I saw the Lovin' Spoonful in November of 1966 in Louisville at Memorial Auditorium. And the first time I ever saw a Les Paul with John Sebastian was playing a 59. And I didn't know what kind of guitar it was. I just thought, what a cool looking little guitar. I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
And I just took a liking to those guitars. And then, lo and behold, a couple of years later, Michael Bloomfield's holding one on Super Sessions. Then next thing you know, Clapton's using one on the back of the Beano album by John Mayall. Then Jimmy Page has got one. And then you see people like Billy Gibbons with Pearly Gates.
Sure.
So I thought as a young man, I knew that was the epitome of what I wanted, the tone that I figured it would produce, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the John Sebastian guitar holds a special place in my heart. His guitar, I think, is a CC-13. And I got a copy of that one. Mm-hmm. And I've also got a copy of the Michael Bloomfield tribute guitar.
Nice.
And I've got a Freddie King tribute guitar, which is a 345. But the cool thing is about the John Sebastian guitar, the one I saw at Memorial Auditorium, I know the owner, who is Gordon Kennedy, owns a guitar, and he brought it to Gibson one day and let me play it. So,
The very guitar that you saw on stage. The
very
first
Les Paul I ever saw.
You've held and played.
I held and played.
That is so
cool. How cool is that?
That is full circle, big time right there.
Yeah, that's a full circle.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the Headhunters. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about guys getting signed. I've heard stories that you guys played, that there was some interest in you, and that you did a show down in Nashville, maybe, Douglas Corner, maybe?
Yeah, and I'm thinking it was 88.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it gets a little cloudy, because I have to go back and look at my little calendars and stuff. But we did a... Jonathan D.W. Lyle, gentleman from Richmond, Virginia, who Doug and I had met at a place called Duke's in Richmond, Virginia. We were with Ronnie McDowell. And one night, we just out of the blue, when Ronnie done his walk-off, we played a Freddie King song. And here comes this gentleman and walks up to us and says, "Hey, you guys like blues?" And yeah, we like blues. And we got talking to Jonathan D.W. Lyle. We start telling about our new little band we had called the Headhunters at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And... he just took a liking to us, and then he made a trip down to Nashville, heard us, and just come around and start hanging with us, and ended up loaning us money to go do what would become Picking on Nashville. So when it first came out, it was on cassettes. Well, we did a 45 too, but that's a different story. And I think he gave us like $5,000, $6,000, mm-hmm. you know. So we went to the sound shop. For a couple of days, we cut 8 of the tracks that would become Picking on Nashville. And we released a little cassette, as you remember, which was
the Pink Tape.
Pink Tape, mm-hmm. yeah, with the Travis Traveler guitar on it. And so we started passing them around. One went to Larry Hamby at Sony or CBS, and he flipped out. And a couple other people were interested, and we had people that Richard had known, like Larry Schell and Tom Long, and a lot of people that he knew from Acuff Rose started talking us up. Now, we had, prior to the Pink Tape, we had done some recording at Acuff Rose,
mm-hmm.
and released that little 45 of Walk Softly, Oh Lonesome Me, mm-hmm. different versions.
Yeah.
And the band really at that point had matured. You listen back, you go, yeah, we really hadn't found our sound yet. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, fast forward. It's around 88. We started getting some interest from labels, and we'd been kind of poking our noses in Nashville at Douglas Corner, Exit Inn. I don't know if we played anywhere else down there or not. We were playing Mr. C's up here. Mm-hmm. Then we ended up playing Picasso's.
Yep.
And it seemed like we played in Louisville one time, too.
You're kind of doing the circuit like most bands.
When we can, because I was out with Ronnie McDowell. Doug was with Ronnie, too. And
So you guys were doing both. You guys didn't.
Oh, yeah.
You were out with Ronnie and then stopped Ronnie and then were Headhunters. You were trying to get the Headhunters going and still
Well, originally, there was no plan. There was no grand plan on getting a record deal. I just thought, man, let's get together, have some fun. Mm-hmm. Originally, we were going to get the band together with, you know, put it together with Anthony Kenny. It was going to be Anthony, Fred, Richard, me. We're just going to get together and play a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But Anthony just didn't really have time to do it at that point. And so I suggested Doug. The guys were a little reluctant. They didn't know who Doug was. They didn't know anything about him.
Mm-hmm.
And they came. I think the first time they saw Doug play was at a show with Ronnie McDowell in Glasgow. Then they came down to Scottsville one night. We were playing down there and checked him out. And then we got together and jammed in my basement
mm-hmm.
a few times, and he seemed to work out fine. This is before Doug. Gosh, it had to be like March, because the band started jamming in March in my basement of 86. Anyway, that's the origins of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you get back to the Pink Tape.
Mm-hmm. Let's
forward back to the Pink Tape. We recorded those songs. Larry Hamby's flipping out at CBS. And there were some other people starting to kind of get interested. So we decided that we needed to book a showcase. And the showcase was at Douglas Corner. Doug and I barely made it in. We had played up in the Richmond, Virginia area the night before Ronnie McDowell. We were late getting out of there. and we got back in town, and we got barely, we more or less changed clothes in the vans and cars.
Sure.
Went and played this show. And when Larry Hamby heard us, he said, well, you guys are really more of a rock band. I don't know what I would do with you guys. But the twist of fate there was Harold Shedd is there. A lot of people were there to check out Leroy Parnell. He was also showcasing that night.
So you knew when you got there, there's going to be some big wigs there. Mm-hmm. They're going to watch us. Mm-hmm. This may turn into something. Yeah. Yes, maybe, maybe no. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was a lot riding on that night. And then when we found out that Larry Hamby turned us down, you know, we kind of like, oh, man, you know, the bummer.
Uh-huh.
But then Harold Shedd walked up to Ricky Phelps and said, wanted a copy of the tape. He heard us play, and he was... thought it was interesting, and he said, how often do you guys play? And of course, Ricky was frustrated because we never play. He said, we never get to play.
Uh-huh.
Of course, I'm sure Harold was like, whoa, you know. And when Leroy Parnell heard us, he said, wow, that's interesting. Heavy metal bluegrass. That's what he says.
Yeah.
So, you know, and the thing that, you know, really solidified everything was Walk Softly.
Mm-hmm.
Harold took a liking to that, you know, the bass drum and the bass and just the vocals. And it was just a very interesting mix of stuff. He, you know, he decided to take a chance on us.
Yeah.
So we signed, oh gosh, early 89.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with Ronnie McDowell up to about June of 89.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were busy, busy, busy.
Pretty busy. I stayed with Ronnie as long as I could because I didn't want to be without a job.
Well, sure. You had that regular check coming in.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I, you know, at some point, Ronnie said, well, you know, when he knew that I was going to have to quit at some point, we ended up bringing Anthony Kenny in on guitar.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony and I were out there on the road for about a month together. We were having a good time, having a great time. And then... Ronnie said, well, I can't afford two guitar players. So finally in June of 89, I took, I said, okay, this is it for me,
yep.
You know, and I took a little job at Record Rack that summer till things went through the summer, and then things slowly, you know, kind of.
That was kind of like your version of I don't have a day job anymore, because you gave up the real day job and took kind of the part-time day job just to keep the lights on and to be close to home to see what was going to happen with this new thing.
Yeah, I mean, I had to be honest with you. I knew it was good, but I didn't know it would do anything. I thought, well, you know, this could be. I just did not know.
Yeah.
I had no clue. I'll be honest with you. It was a leap of faith. It was blind faith, and I can't tell you that I thought it was just going to go through the roof. I didn't know, but obviously it worked out, and I worked a Record Rack up to about the Christmas season of 89. I was able to, you know, the album came out, and we were starting to go out and do a few dates, but the Kingreys would let me come in and work a little bit, and then I finally. Early 90, I said, I can't do it, both of them.
So. Yeah.
And they were good with it.
Well, they were expecting that anyway. They were probably all happy
for
you.
They knew that, yeah.
They're like,
Betty and Kevin were great. You know, there's people like Betty and Kevin that were so supportive like that. And then you got people like Joy Berry at WLOC, him and his dad, Jim, and the family, that would let us come in and do the, you know...
The Chillin' Show.
The Chillin' Show.
Yeah.
The old station up there. So, and it was cool. It was cool. A lot of people. I mean, as you know, when you do different things as you're planting seeds, but playing with other people, just like Richard is writing at Acuff Rose, you know, back in the 80s, you know, he was trying to write songs for people like Alabama and came real close to getting a cut with them. In the big picture, he was planting seeds. You're getting to know people like Larry Schell, Tom Long. Tom Long goes way back to Itchy Brother. But it's just so funny how your life is impacted by friendships you end up making and how they can open the doors later on, you know.
And then later, when you get somewhere, you kind of turn around and look back and said, man, look at all those people that really, you know, gave me a helping hand, you know, pat me on the back, you know, encouraged me, you know, kind of let me be free and kind of do what I needed to do.
Yeah.
It really does take a village sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, and it took everybody knowing different people to make that band work. And it was a really special, and I must say that original Headhunters has a special chemistry that really connected with people, you know. Now, the new band is more of a Southern rock thing. That band was... It kind of bridged the gap between Southern rock and country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not comparing either one of them, you know. I look at things going, well, you can't go back to them. Well, no. That was your, you know, I can't be 5'4 again, even though I might shrink back to it.
Well, I mean, you know, those were steps. All those baby bands, steps. All those years, yeah. All those projects were all steps to where mm-hmm. you are now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of them as a fan, because, mm-hmm. you know, you and I are friends now, but I didn't know you back in the sure. early days of the Headhunters. The way I discovered the Headhunters is the station that we both work for, D93,
yeah.
is at that time D98. You know, I was a listener like everyone else, yeah. kind of aspiring someday I would like to maybe be in radio. And I remember when they were playing tunes off that first album, I was blown away by that. I was like, these guys are wow. from Kentucky?
Wow.
And so I was...
You talking about Picking on Nashville?
Yeah.
You
heard it? Okay. I was recording stuff off the radio, mm-hmm. calling them up and say, hey, play that, you know, Daddy Was a Milkman tune. And I was recording it, and I was sending it to friends of mine in Arkansas, because mm-hmm. I had just moved from Arkansas, and, you know, saying, check out this band that's like, if they're from
you know,
here.
It's funny because Billy Gibbons, when he heard our album, he was like buying copies for people. You know, and I found that out from James Harmon, the guy that plays harmonica on a lot of their albums.
Uh-huh.
You know, then me and Billy became buddies, you know, like 90, 91, something like that. And mm-hmm. he's always been very supportive.
Well, there's another band supporting a lot now, too.
Otis.
Uh-huh.
He loves Otis.
That's right.
He does yeah. love Otis. He actually loves Otis a lot.
Yeah. Recently saw a photo of you and Jeff Beck, and it looked like Jeff Beck had a copy
yeah,
of Otis
yeah,
CD,
we
too.
Made. I gave him the Johnny Johnson album,
mm-hmm.
Meet Me in Blues Land, and he was excited about that because all the English cats like Jeff and Jimmy Page and Eric Clapton love Johnny Johnson.
Yeah.
So he was excited when he found out that Johnny was on that one CD. He started mimicking Johnny's little piano sounds.
Uh-huh.
And then I gave him the Otis, and then we found out that Billy Gibbons was actually doing the same thing. He was making copies of the Otis album, handing them out to Jeff Beck's bunch, which is really great when you find out stuff like
well,
that.
It's super nice. Yeah. You're like, if those guys dig it enough that they're handing it out to their buddies, yeah. there's got to be something, because yeah. you know they're not going to hand their buddies something that says... You know.
Here, listen to this. Yeah, listen to this. Stinks,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, their buddies call them up. What's this you gave me?
Well, this is a
coaster now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Headhunters, the first album, you guys go in, you press it, it's out. You're still working a little bit at the record store. How is that to be working at a record shop in Glasgow, and then your own album is on the shelves in front of you?
Oh, it's real cool, but let me tell you. The day that the Walk Softly video premiered on CMT. We had a TV. Were you ever in an old record rack at all?
Yeah, I was there a couple times, yeah.
It was a TV used to kind of hang off the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
So you could watch TV during the day from the counter.
Uh-huh.
And there was a laundromat next door. Well, there was a little young kid came in one day. They were always coming in wanting change, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And he came in one day, and I was watching TV because the premiere was getting ready to happen. So the premiere starts, and I'm watching it, and this little kid comes in. He looks up at the TV, and he looks back at the counter. He looks at the TV. He goes, I said, Mister, is that you? I said, yes, sir.
How wild is that?
So how cool is that?
You watched the premiere
yeah, at Record Rack.
At your day job on the TV.
Yeah, at Record Rack. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And when it came out, yeah, I was selling them off the shelf. Selling them, yeah.
Just like that. People were walking.
Selling CDs, cassettes, and albums, all three formats.
Were they asking you to autograph them after they bought them from you?
Yeah, sure.
That has got to be something else.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll sign it for you. Take the plastic off. There you go, buddy.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Then we ended up, of course, Walmart were able to help us a lot more back then, you know. Mm-hmm. Nothing against Walmarts, but back then it was a little more family. Not family.
I know you guys did some signings and
we
stuff
did.
At
we
Walmart.
Used to, yeah, that's right. Yeah. We did. And we did stuff at the Record Rack as well. You know, and then we did. Did we do something down here maybe? Surely we did something at, I don't know.
Yeah. It's all a blur.
It's a blur. It's a haze now, man.
So that's pretty amazing stuff. The thing of it is, Greg, is that you've had such a long history in music that there's no way that we would ever, ever, ever have time for all the stories. Yeah. But we want to try to get a couple more out of you for this edition of the Sound Atlas.
Okay.
So we talked a little bit about Ed King. We talked about the guitar. I figured that would be
something. And of course, Ed has passed on, which is sad.
Sadly.
I loved Ed. Ed was a nice human, man. Mm-hmm. Really, really.
Now, this is one of those questions that I'm sure people ask you all the time, but I'm curious. Are there any particular times maybe you guys out on the road where you're like, man, there was that one time back in 92 or back in so-and-so when that one crazy thing happened when we were playing on stage, something weird, you know, crazy experiences on the road? I know you guys have played thousands of shows by now, but there's got to be a couple.
I think the craziest thing to ever happen was actually with Itchy Brother.
Really?
Yeah, we're playing at the... I mean, yeah, I'm sure. With the Headhunters, I mean, you know, we've had some great shows. Mm-hmm. I can't, you know. But I think one of the craziest things to ever happen was in 1978, Itchy Brother was playing at the flea market, and we borrowed Slick Rock's Plash Pots.
Uh-huh.
You don't know this story, do you?
No, but it already sounds good.
We borrowed them. Billy Judd built them.
Uh-huh.
So we packed them up with gunpowder or whatever you use in these things, or flash powder or whatever it is. You had these two.
Like, it looked like coffee cans, kind of?
I guess. I can't remember. This is like, I can't believe we even did it. But anyway, at the time, Don Taylor was our light man. So he's over talking to a girl. So on our grand finale, he's over talking to this girl, and he sets off the flash pots. He just forgot that Richard Young was standing over one of them.
Ooh.
So Richard Young gets part of his hair singed.
Wow.
And he could have had his eyes put out.
Yeah.
But to me, that stands out more than anything. You know, I mean, is that kind of what you're talking about?
So you're saying that someone was nearly killed, and so, well, that story sticks out. I can see that.
He could have had his eyes put out or something crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had some cool things. Well, I'll tell you, yeah, that's a weird thing. I'll tell you a surreal moment is when we were playing out in Sacramento or somewhere one night, and then, you know, I got to be really good friends with Ronnie Montrose, and he showed up and sat in with us.
Yeah.
And I thought, my gosh, how cool is
Ronnie Montrose?
Having Ronnie Montrose, because, you know, in the mid-70s, I just thought he hung the moon. I thought he was it. And later on as well, when we become real good friends, he actually wanted to produce me, and we even got talking about producing another Rufus Huff, mm-hmm. but unfortunately didn't come to be because of his health issues and all that. But yeah, just seeing Ronnie come out and jam with us and just doing the Johnny Johnson stuff. I mean, things like that, mm-hmm. you just can't envision that when you're young, you know. Let's face it, Tommy. I mean, this is what's so crazy. Like, in November, we'll mark 50 years when I first met Richard and Fred.
Really?
So yeah.
You know when you guys met?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I can tell you the first time me and Richard played out in public was in November. I can't give you the exact. It's like November 21st, 2nd of November at a 4-H talent contest. I've got the little clipping out of the paper.
I've seen
it,
that.
It wasn't. This is before I met Fred.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, as soon as I met Richard, we hit it off, and I started going over jamming with them. So it was like November of 1968, which will be 50 years. At that point, when you're young and you're growing up in Edmonton, myself, I was like going, man, it would be cool playing the skating rink.
Sure.
Then the next thing you go, wow, how cool would it be playing at the Armory, you know? And then you start setting your goals different. But it's just been one crazy trip, you know?
You know, even when you get your first record out, wouldn't it be cool if we won an award? Mm. You guys won awards.
We did. And yeah. I never even thought about awards, honestly. I don't know if anybody did, but, you know, even a Grammy, you just go, that's like going to the moon. I never even thought about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Itchy Brother. You went way back. How about that 45? What was that, 1973?
Yeah, the 45.
Was that the very first thing that you were ever on?
No. Actually, no. I played on gospel sessions when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Richard, Fred, Anthony, and I went into a little studio when we were kids, I mean, in high school, and cut 4 or 5 songs onto an acetate, but I have no idea where the acetate is.
Oh, yeah. So that's gone, you
It's
think.
Gone. It's gone. Yeah, we did like Blue Suede Shoes, You Are My Sunshine, Sonny Boy Williamson by Michael Bloomfield, and I can't remember what the other song was. First time I ever went in a studio was my first time. I think it was actually with a group called Cool Blue.
Oh, I've seen that. Aren't you wearing a fire hat or something?
Yeah, Cool Blue was the first time I ever went in the studio, and that was 1970, 69 or 70.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then from then on, I started playing bass or guitar, even played drums on a gospel thing one time. Wow. Just whenever Wayne Sexton would call up and say, I need guitar. Or I know I played on a Temple Trio album, mm-hmm. Joymakers, different people like that.
Do you have copies of all of that that you were
some
on?
Of that. Some of that mm-hmm. I've got it at home, yeah. Yeah.
But real quick, sure. The 45, the 73 45, how'd that come about?
Oh, that. Well, I moved to Louisville in 72, so I had to quit the band for a bit. But there was a brief period, Richard, Fred, Auntie, and I got back together. Effie Young funded that. I'm best I remember, she funded that. We went to a studio in Burkesville, Kentucky, mm-hmm. that Wayne Sexton ran, and Stanley Lawson, I can't even think the name of the studio now. Mm-hmm. I think we got together on their front porch, and I had written Shotgun Effie, mm-hmm. and Richard had written Rock and Roller. And I sang Shotgun Effie, and he sang Rock and Roller. And it seemed like it came out like early 74. It was mm-hmm. seemed like it was late 73 when it was recorded, and then mm-hmm. it came out in 74.
Yeah, I know not too long ago, a couple of years back, I got a call or an email or something from Dean Smith, said that he had found some up in his attic, and he wanted
you to... You got your copy, right?
Well, I had a copy before, but he said, well, these are pristine.
I got a couple of them stashed back now.
Well, sure. Well, you need to have a couple of those stashed back.
Got them.
Let's talk a little bit about the practice house.
It's still there.
Yeah,
I don't get out there very often anymore, but Richard's there every day.
I think he is. He's got an office out there.
He's got an office. Yeah, I think the last time I was there was last year sometime.
You haven't been there since last year?
Oh, man, I'm not up there very much at all. Yeah.
But so you guys don't get together. Do you still play there? Do you get together
If we're going to write something, yeah, we get together and write there.
Yeah. Some people will ask me, and I'm like, ask them.
Well, we've been going up there since we're kids, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember going up there. First time I ever stepped in there was probably, I remember it being real cold. It was cold. And it was cold. It had to be like the winter of 68, like late winter or something.
Just
you know?
Right after you guys met.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember going out there and jamming. But then there was a period, then we jammed in it. Oh, we were out there for quite a while up through early 70s, but it seemed like there was a time... I thought somebody maybe moved in there for a while, but maybe I'm wrong about that. I must mm-hmm. be wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
But that was a place that you guys would go when band got together and practice and rehearse and put songs together, the whole deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's say that maybe you're going to go and start working on a new album. You guys would kind of start there.
Yeah, right. That's where you would go,
That's kind of a go and get together kind of thing.
Yeah.
Of course, Blackstone Cherry kind of took it over a little bit.
They took it over? I guess they still go up there. I don't know where. Did they still go there?
I don't know.
I never see them anymore.
I assume they probably do.
Yeah.
Now, what about that? What's your take on Blackstone Cherry? What about that?
They're a great band.
Yeah.
They're a great band.
Mm-hmm. And they're doing well. And, of course, Otis. And I mentioned Boone a little bit earlier. He told us how you kind of put the John Brim idea in their head.
Well,
and how that came about.
I always thought that John Brim, a lot of folks in Kentucky, I mean, the Blues Society folks are hip to him.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people don't realize that he wrote Ice Cream Man, mm-hmm. Rattlesnake, and things like that. And I just had this idea that some young band that really liked blues, and I knew that Otis really liked blues. You know, they weren't out to be Nickelback. I'm not putting Nickelback down, but I'm just saying they wanted to be to know about the blues.
Sure.
So I met them up at Moose's one night. And I gave my idea, and they just lapped it up.
Yeah.
We started listening to John Brim, and they came up with some great arrangements on that stuff.
They're a good band.
They're really good. I saw them play, as you did, 2 weeks ago, week ago.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
Yeah. Well, when this airs, it'll be about a month ago. Month ago in Edmonton.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. This will be a minute for this.
Yep.
This airs.
Yep. And then my grandkids, Sour Cream, I just got a copy of their little, it's not final, but I've got a copy of what their little album's going to be like.
You do? You got it with you?
Yep. It's not by no means final, but it's really good for... I mean, when I listen to it, you know, there's some maturing that needs to happen, you know, here and there. There's some things you go, well, and I wasn't really in on the cutting floor of that stuff. I was out there one day when they were doing Dynamic, you know, the old Itchy Brothers song.
Sure.
and they made me play on it.
Those listening maybe don't know who that is. Explain to them who Sour Cream is.
Oh, Sour Cream. Sour Cream are my stepkids, two of my stepkids, John Ellis McGee and Harlan Earl Cecil. Mm-hmm. Harlan Earl plays guitar. John Ellis plays drums. And
they're from Lexington.
From Lexington. Mm-hmm. Kobe Grant plays bass. Yeah, they're a little trio.
They're like, trio. They're 17, 18 years old, maybe?
They're a power trio. They're kind of like an extension of, they took Itchy Brother, Black Cat Bone, and Tail Dragger, and just mixed what they do.
Yeah.
It's just like, you go, wow. You can kind of hear yourself in what they're doing.
So we're hoping maybe by the first of next year, they'll have something available?
I think so. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be their first little release, so to speak. And David Barrick and Johnny pretty much spearheaded it, I think.
Yeah. So they recorded that David Barrick's.
Yep, David just mixed it. Now, I don't know if the mixes are final yet. I think there's, you know, there may be some tweaking to do.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
But now, what about the Greg Martin Group? What's going on with the Greg Martin Group? Anything? I know you cut some tracks last year.
Yeah, we did cut some tracks. And we're actually doing some shows in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we're going to Nashville, but we are.
I guess you need some new boots. And while you're down there, you're going to play a show.
We're
going
to be playing Nashville, Tennessee, you know.
Yeah.
Man, I think, you know, we got some gigs coming up. Probably go back to the studio. I'm thinking what we might do is just go in one day and just cut songs we know and have David mix it on the spot and just throw it up on, give them away.
Just see what happens.
I'm just thinking now, we can do a CD later at some point, eventually when we get enough tracks cut. But just give the music away. I mean, you know, if it's a cover, obviously you won't pay the writer, you know, but at this point, just let people have it.
Yeah.
Do you see people doing that often now?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a lot of bands do that. Yeah. I mean, a lot of the newer bands around here do that. They kind of give a little bit of the you know, the music away to kind of put a taste out there for everybody, see what they think, kind of get them, you know, used to what they sound like, you know, see them live, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And then when they go in the studio and have a product ready, hopefully they've kind of got people primed for it, I guess is a good way to put it.
So, I mean, and of course, Dean Smith on bass. Steve Holmes from Buster Brown on drums, Thane Sheeran from Cold Truth on vocals, and we'll probably play, I'd say we'll play the PTK this year, you know, at some point.
Yeah, you guys usually do that once a year
around Christmas,
at least.
Yeah. And probably have the Sour Creamers come back and play.
That would be nice.
Kick our butts, you know.
Yeah. So we've given folks a few stories, the Greg Martin Odyssey so far, but that's just such a tip of the iceberg.
Well, it's strange how things kind of work, you know, how things, your life, you know. When I got out of school, I mean, I loved music. I knew I was going to play guitar. I knew, obviously, around 68, I knew that guitar was going to be what I did or was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But I had no grand scheme of things on, like, okay, I want to be a rock and roll star. When I got out of school, I thought, well, I would just get me a job, and I'll just do whatever I do, you know.
Sure.
And then the music thing kind of won out, which was a good thing. But it was a God thing, the whole thing. It's nothing I did. Nobody did. It's just, it was supposed to happen. By the grace of God, I took the right steps and made a few mistakes. Still make a few mistakes, but
nobody's perfect, right?
You know,
and just, hopefully you learn.
Just never admit them, kids.
That's right. now, what about the Headhunters? I have been hearing that some new stuff may be coming out next year. I don't know how much of that you can talk about.
There's a live album.
There's a live album coming out next year. Yeah. What can you tell us about that?
It's a Headhunters, and it'll be some stuff cut at Ramblin' Man, recorded at Ramblin'. I think it's safe to say that, you know.
Okay.
When's this coming out?
This will be out in 2 or 3 weeks, probably mid-October.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know if I'm supposed to talk about that or not. But
we can skip over it.
Yeah. We can always cut this out. We can figure it. We'll talk about it.
Or we can leave it in and we can tell them that we cut it out. But they don't know what we cut out or what we left in.
Yeah, we don't know. Yeah, there's a live album coming out. Yeah. I won't really get into the gist of it.
Headhunters live album maybe next year, and that's all they need to know right now.
Yeah, that's all they need to know right now.
Okay. So everything's still going well with the Headhunters? Yeah. You guys seem to be very busy on the road.
Busy. Can't complain.
Yeah. Okay.
I can't complain, man. Yeah. I mean, you know.
Are you
tired?
Well, hey, man, you won't be a rock star.
I'm 65.
You won't be a rock star, man.
No, I don't want to be a rock star.
Well,
that was never my plan.
Well, you get out there and you're good.
You
man.
Know what? No, I'll take it back. When I was a teenager and I saw the Beatles, I thought, well, it'd be cool being like that. Then I learned pretty quick that that there's not very many like that, you know, because stars fade except for the Beatles and Hendrix and people like that.
Yeah. All right, real quick, if we're getting ready to wrap it up, guitar players, give me some guitar. Give people listening some guitar players out there that that they need to check out.
Well, Ronnie Montrose, as we said, you got to listen to Ronnie Montrose, especially the first Montrose album. Jimmy Page for... Everybody needs to hear Jimmy Page, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Michael Bloomfield, Billy F. Gibbons. Go back to listen to the early sides. Albert King, Freddie King, B.B. King. Mm-hmm.
All three kings.
Listen to the slide guitar of Muddy Waters. Listen to Earl Hooker, Chet Atkins, Merle Travis. Oh, gosh, there's so many. As far as my favorite newer guitar player... Well, he's Jack Pearson. I love Jack Pearson, who lives in Nashville.
Sure.
He's really more of a jazz blues guy, you know, and does his organ trio thing. Gosh, who else? I love people like Humble Pie, you know, with Frampton Marriott.
What Humble Pie album should folks check out? The one album.
Rockin' the Fillmore and Smokin' are my two favorites. But you know what? All of them are really good. Thunderbox is real good. Street Rats, they started kind of maybe running out of ideas. But, man, I think the Rockin' the Fillmore album is really great. Do you like that one?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I like the extended four discer. It's really good, too.
Oh, you know, and there's just so many great players.
What about Hendrix?
Jimi Hendrix. Did I forget? I didn't even... Well, Jimmy is my favorite.
Yeah. What is the Hendrix song? Like, every time you hear
that
song.
Well, every time I hear it, it would have to be All Along the Watchtower, his rendition of that. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely my favorite guitarist. Mm-hmm. He really is.
So,
I mean... There's just something special about him.
See, I like it. You're getting all excited.
I get excited about Hendrix.
You're like, this is Hendrix.
And, I mean, I play Les Paul, and he played a Strat, but, man, there's nobody like Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, but you mentioned Jimmy Page. I know you're a huge Jimmy Page fan.
Yeah, I really love Jimmy Page, you know, in the 70s, and I still love Jimmy Page. You know, I mean, who didn't? I mean, how could you not love Led Zeppelin? Uh-huh. Or even going back to the Yardbirds, the stuff he did with the Yardbirds. I mean, I love Jimmy Page. And, you know, I love Clapton's early sides with Cream and John Mayall. And then him switching over to the Strat on Derek and the Dominoes. I love that. I even like his 70s stuff where he was kind of going to the Tulsa sound, you know. Yeah. Oh, gosh, who else? There's so many.
What's the Zeppelin album?
It would have to be the first two albums.
First two.
Yeah.
Actually, the third one is my favorite.
Really?
I can understand.
I can see that. It's very, very diverse, isn't it?
It's different. There's a lot of acoustic stuff on there. There's a lot of kind of chunky, heavy stuff. I would say hats off to Roy Harper. It's probably my all-time favorite tune.
Yeah. I mean, I love Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Obviously. I got the first Zeppelin album in a trade from Tommy Lane Shirley, who was in a record... in a record club, I got Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young, which was a great album. Mm-hmm. Tommy got the Led Zeppelin album. He wasn't real crazy about it. We swapped, and I was just tickled to death. I went and put on the Zeppelin album, and when Good Times, Bad Times come on, I went, oh, my gosh. Another guitar player I love a lot is Todd Rundgren. Mm-hmm. Todd Rundgren, and he had a group called Naz. Amazing. And there again, man, I never discount guys that were local guys like Kenny Lee Smith, who played with Buster Brown. Mm-hmm. There's a gentleman by the name of Ken Musnug, had a group called Us Incorporated. These guys locally here, Guy Iverson, who had a group called Soul Ship, those guys were early influences. Mm-hmm. Back then, when you're growing up, man, you look at these guys, but now you also... There were bands out of Louisville like the Rugbys, Elysian Field, Soul Incorporated, the Oxfords. Those bands were big influences, too. Yeah. Steve Ferguson within RBQ, you know.
Well, it's just kind of like these days when a lot of the bands are coming up, you are one of their influences.
Well, that's nice to somebody even say that.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, Boone Froggatt, when we talked to him, he mentioned your name quite a bit.
Oh, well, that's sweet.
Not only because he likes your playing, but because you guys... have been so...
I love them, guys. I love them, boys. We're good friends.
Yeah.
They're good. You know, and I want the best for them guys. I kind of helped them early on, and I intentionally just kind of backed off during their second album to let them work with David and Paul Nelson, and it was not out of anything. The thing is, man, I don't have to be involved in everything, but you know, we'll work together again on something. You know, yeah. I know some. I don't know what it'll be. And I really, really love my grandson's playing. I can't tell you how much I like Harlan.
Yeah,
he's just blowing me away.
A lot of talented folks here in South Central Kentucky. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, when I was listening to Harlan, I'm going, and I was told Ruth's listening in the kitchen. She says, "Well, he stole every lick that you've, he's got every lick that you've done." And I went, "I guess as long as he's playing, I'll always be pretty well represented." You know?
There you go.
And but I hear a lot of Todd Rundgren in his playing, which I don't. I just hear a I don't hear kids playing like he plays. Mm-hmm. It's just weird. I guess our record collections help him. Johnny McGee. I really love Johnny McGee's playing, too. I love Chris and Ben, too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I love all them guys,
but,
man.
But you mentioned Johnny. Johnny's, whatever he picks up, he's good at it. Guitar, Johnny's so drum. Talented. He's just such a talented guy.
Yeah. I married well.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize when I married Ruth that Johnny and Sherry, they're both talented. I'm just blessed. Yeah. You know, God is good.
We're talking about all these young musicians in the area. Let me ask
God,
you this.
Oh, God, there's so many.
If there are some bands listening right now, maybe some aspiring musicians, what is some real good, solid advice you can give them?
Well, the thing you really need to do is be yourself. Always listen and be teachable. Be teachable. But don't go chasing fads. Let your influences, listen to music, let it seep in. Because when it comes out, it'll come out into your own little burgoo, so to speak, And just be true to yourself. Stay away from drugs and alcohol. I mean, honestly, I know that I sound like a Sunday school teacher, but...
Well, you've been out there. You've seen.
Man, I've seen it. I've tasted it. I've got the shirt. I've done it. I've done it all. Uh-huh. And the thing is, you just don't mature what happens. Music is really special to be able to be... That the good Lord would let you even play an instrument. And then when you get to share music, it's like... The way I look at... I've drank enough to put somebody under a, I've never had a real problem with it, but just always wanted more. But the thing is, it's like you're a light. And why would you want to pour something over a light? Mm-hmm. And that's the way I look at alcohol or drugs.
It
diminishes the light.
Yeah.
You're a bright light, man. Mm-hmm. Play, do what God give you to do. Just be true to yourself and follow your gut instinct, follow your dreams. Trust in the Lord.
All right,
the good Lord knows what's going on.
We're going to let that be it because I think
read your Bible too.
Some good advice.
I read the Bible every day.
All right,
I'm going to read to you when I get done.